Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Yakir Englander, your host today. And today we're going to talk with Bjorn Krondorfer. Bjorn, you are a professor of religious studies in North Arizona University at the Department of Comparative Cultural Studies. And your field is religion, also gender, culture, and Holocaust studies. Today, we're going to focus on the new book that you edited together with Ovidio Crianda. Can you help me how to say it right?
Crianda,
thank you so much. Which the title is The Holocaust and Masculinities, Critical Inquiries into the Present and Absence of Men. So before we're going to delve into the questions and the subjects that you bring by different scholars in this book, I wonder if you can share with us a bit about your personal interest in subject as the Holocaust and masculinities.
Yeah, I would be happy to do so. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak about this topic, about the book that just came out, and trying to explain the significance of that theme, which is actually not so easy to do, and hopefully put it in context that that makes sense to people who haven't thought much about this particular area of study. I grew up in Germany, in post-war Germany. I came to the United States at age 24 for a graduate studies program in Philadelphia, not knowing that I might end up staying in the United States, but that is where I still am in the year 2020. And giving my academic interest in comparative religious studies as well as in gender studies. I mean, that is kind of the one branch of interest that got me to think about masculinities and the Holocaust. And the other one is really my encounter with the Jewish community in the 1980s in the United States as a non-Jewish, young German, trying to make sense of Germany's history and the legacy, this dark legacy. And so it has become a lifelong interest to really understand the Holocaust, the history, the legacy, the repercussions, and what to do with such a traumatic, horrific event. And so that at some point I would become interested in masculinities and the Holocaust, I think seems almost fated. But it took me many years to get there. Today, I am the director of the Martin Springer Institute at Northern Arizona University. We are located in Flagstaff. That institute was founded by a Holocaust survivor from Benzin in Poland. She and her whole family survived. She survived as a teenager in different labor camps and eventually found her way to Flagstaff. She and her second husband, Ralph Martin, they decided to give a small endowment to the university to start an educational institute that looks at the history of the Holocaust, but also at all issues that need our attention today, where there's some grave injustice in one form or the other. So we have a dual mandate to look at the past and the present. That's my current situation, but my research continues, and this book on masculinities and the Holocaust is one of my recent, the fruits of my recent labor, so to speak.
Thank you. So what we can understand better about the Holocaust by focusing on gender in general and with on masculinity in a specific?
Yeah. As we start our conversation today, I want to preface this by saying that it is to think about men and masculinities and the Holocaust is complicated. And so if I sometimes look for the right words to express why it is an important subject, it has to do with the subject matter itself. Mm. So those who are listening and they feel like, oh, now Bjorn is having trouble to explain himself correctly, I think it has to do with the fact that men, we could say, are everywhere, but we don't really think about them in a particular way as gendered beings, as beings that have a particular gendered experience or the male gendered experience, because we take men for granted, their experience, and it's the norm. It's the way how we are in the world that doesn't need further inquiry or further investigation. And then somehow how to make men visible as gendered beings is complicated. And so when I try to use examples or express it, it will be sometimes a little difficult. And you will help me to get through this.
We will do it together.
You may need to rephrase your question because I forgot you.
So, of course. So I really wonder, I mean, there is so much literature about the Holocaust. And we look at this phenomena, this event in from different angles. And I wonder, by using the questions of gender or the subject of gender,
right,
and in more specific with masculinity, which is for me, there is not so much literature about that. Like, right, what does it mean to, or what kind of light we can understand, or what we can understand better about the Holocaust by focusing on masculinity?
So as we know, the literature on the Holocaust is huge. I mean, from, you know, simply historical studies, but also literary works on the Holocaust, films. I mean, it's an endlessly wide field at this point. Gender studies were applied to Holocaust studies not until maybe the mid-1980s in a more sustained form. So before that, somehow people didn't ask really the question whether there's anything to be learned about the Holocaust if we look at men and women separately, and in more current times, even what is known as non-binary people, you know, possibly transgender people. That is a very late phenomenon to actually bring this into the debate. But really in the 1980s, women historians, mostly women historians, felt that the field is dominated by men who do the research, and the field is dominated by looking at testimonies that were left by men, or court documents, or archives, or written memoirs, whatever, or the speakers. It was a fairly male-dominated field. Not that women were completely sidelined, but they weren't prominent. Both women's voices from the Holocaust, but also scholars thinking about the particular experiences of women as women during this time. And so almost simultaneously, women historians began to look at women who were complicit or bystanders or even perpetrators in Nazi Germany, as well as looking at Jewish women's experience. That's where the gender issues became prominent. And then it took several decades for people to think that, you know, it's not only women who have a gender, but men who have a gender. Yes. And rather than taking men's experiences for granted, as as if this is nothing that we need to look at differently from women's experiences. That's kind of when the field started slowly to emerge, to also think about gender in terms of masculinities or of men. And there are studies here and there, but actually there hasn't been really a volume published with that particular title and that particular issue in its center until, I would say, the volume we just published.
So when you start thinking...
But it's not completely new ground. It is based on what some people have begun to write and think about in this field.
So when you...
This is kind of the history of it. It doesn't tell you about the...
Yes, so
advantage.
This is what I mean. Right, which is now what I want to understand better, and we would love to hear from you. So when you and Ovidio, you decided to invite scholars to think about different elements and aspects of masculinity with the Holocaust, what you had in your mind, and what did you learn by this project? Like, because I believe that each scholar probably they wrote their piece, but as editors, you have the gestalt, you have the big picture. And I wonder, can you share with us something that you take with yourself now by this book? Like, what did you learn about masculinity in the Holocaust?
So what we wanted to do is to make visible what the range of choices had been that men had and that perhaps women didn't have. And then if there is a certain range of choices, which obviously was broader than for many women, both among perpetrators as well as victims or victim groups, we still didn't want to bring it down to the very simple equation that most perpetrators were men. There's a very small group of perpetrators were women, but really most perpetrators during the Holocaust and the genocidal assault against Jews were men. But that doesn't mean that all men were perpetrators. So when we look at what was the range of choices that men had, what was their behavior, what was their experience that led them to make a particular decision at a particular moment in time, what was the context that allowed them to do so? What was the privilege, perhaps, of making choices that women didn't have? What kind of powers did they have? Did they discriminate among themselves? What were the forces that helped men to bond to each other to commit genocides? What were the social bonds that had to be broken in the ghettos so that men would perhaps fight each other, Jewish men, target for death, fight each other or keep certain hierarchies in place that excluded women or at some point included women. All of these issues really need more attention than we have given it so far.
Oh, thank you. This really brings new light and ideas. So I want to try to take maybe one of the subjects that is walking with me for a long time. And this is the image of the Jewish community and the Jewish men. So what I'm learning from the readings is that when we think about honor culture, about like that where separation between men and women is very strong and the role of each gender is very clear, men needs to be much more like a fighter, and needs to be like an honorable man. And for many generations, mostly in Europe, the Jewish community were unhonorable people, and Jewish men were unhonorable. I'm just thinking about the fact that Jews were not involved they were not invited to join the military in many centuries, or they were not invited to duel because they are not honorable men. Only honorable men can have a duel and decide who is more strong, but they both have honor. And then comes the Holocaust. And during these years, right, the Jewish men, again, many times, don't behave as what expected men to behave. And the situation is that they cannot fight and they cannot secure themselves. And I wonder if you can help us to understand from both sides what we can learn about how Nazis look on Jewish men and how Jewish men understood themselves by having the sight of the Nazis on themselves.
Right. Now you're opening a bag of many, many issues and questions. To give you a few maybe ideas or examples, I'm more comfortable to speak about respectability and masculinity and leave the honors question a little to the side, because, you know, Europe didn't really have a strong honors social value in the same sense maybe that some other cultures have. It's not an honors culture, but respectability for men is fairly important. And we certainly know that in Europe, Christian Europe, even when it became secular with its beginning of nation states, that Jewish men and Jewish women, but Jewish men were seen as less respectable within the normative ideas about masculinity in the rest of Europe. And every culture and every nation had slightly different ways of looking at this, but generally speaking, Jewish men were seen as more effeminate, not strong, not military-minded, because they were excluded for all these centuries. And there was definitely the sense of an effeminizing of Jewish men. And as assimilation occurred and Jews were allowed to enter mainstream society, they were trying hard to kind of enter those normative masculinities or emulate normative masculinities of the time. And some were successful and some were not. I mean, generally speaking, the more religious a community remained, what we now call Orthodox, the more what they were seen within the old patterns of less masculine men. And the more people assimilated, men assimilated, they were seen as acceptable and following certain cultural standards. But as we also know, never fully accepted. I mean, here and there, but generally speaking, never fully accepted as a true representation of masculine values, to the point that we had this moment of Jewish sports club and athletic clubs that were being created, including the idea of a Muskeljudentum, a muscular Judaism, that wanted to prove to the rest of the non-Jewish world, the Gentile world, that they are as masculine as everyone else. Then the pride among German Jews to have fought in World War I on the side of the German army and having been highly decorated, and even pride in having lost so many Jewish men in the battlefield as a show of strength and national commitment. And ironically, so none of that helped.
So it's so fascinating. So can you... It's one of the mysterious places for me. So Jews fought in the First World War in the German army, Austro-Hungary army, and then they were accepted as real men, with quotation I'm putting here, as real men, or still after that the Nazi propaganda tried to shake it again?
They did. And now again, we're talking about one slice of the Holocaust in Europe, because this is Germany where it started, but it wouldn't, that what I'm saying now doesn't apply to Poland or to Bulgaria or to the Netherlands or France in equal way. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, everyone had a different cultural context or national context. Yeah. But in Germany, World War I was really the moment where assimilated German citizens of Jewish descent, and I put it this way because not all of them would say they were Jews in a religious way anymore, and not even connected to a Jewish community or religious community. But they felt a certain pride in their national German identity, having been allowed to take on German citizenship in 1871, which is really not, between 1871 and 1914, that's one generation only.
Right.
And that World War II gave them opportunity to prove themselves. doesn't mean that they were necessarily accepted by their non-Jewish comrades everywhere, but in many cases they were. And it was, I mean, if I go back to your word of honor, it was kind of a badge of honor to have been in the trenches as Germans, even though they were also of Jewish descent and sometimes already of mixed marriages. Ironically, precisely because Jewish men and Jewish women, the Jewish community, became so assimilated, almost indistinguishable in German society, is why Nazi propaganda had to work so hard to portray them as hostile and dangerous and an enemy, because they really have become, to some extent, invisible. Nazi propaganda had to make them visible again as Jewish men and as Jewish women. And, you know, it took, I mean, 1871, Jews get the citizenship. But at the same time, we have the first German political parties running on anti-Semitic platforms. So these two things go together. You know, modern racial anti-Semitism gets stronger the moment Jews are allowed to enter society as a full citizen with full legal rights. So we have both phenomena at the same time. And for a while, it looked like it would work, and the Nazi propaganda destroyed, Nazism, with its propaganda, destroyed all that progress that was made to integrate different communities.
Mm. Another important chapters in your new book is focusing on masculinity in the camps. And I wonder.
Can I take one step before
please,
there?
Of course.
So now we talk about 1914 to 1918. What
yes.
happened between this and 1933?
Please.
And then really 1938. And just a few lines about this.
Please.
So one thing that really confounded Jewish men during the Weimar Republic, but then the first 6 years of Nazi Germany between 1933 and 1939, is the fact that they were so forcefully excluded from all professions and social life and education life in Germany. So that was the moment where Jewish men were hurt on the level of respect, hurt on the level of their professional identity as successful men in German society. And if you read the memoirs or the letters, that's what they kind of focus on, because they were not yet under physical assault, with a few exceptions. But it wasn't a widespread physical assault against Jewish men between 1933 and 1939. Kristallnacht begins to change it in 1938. But it was like a loss of male privilege as Jewish men in Germany. And that must have been extremely painful and humiliating. And we kind of forget this aspect because we focus so much of what happens then in the camps and then the ghettos as a final stage of the Holocaust. But it started much earlier, and men had to cope with that loss of what we call honor, respectability, and probably then with some shame that they were excluded and couldn't provide to the same things to their families and basically felt helpless and powerless to change the situation. But that clearly has an effect on our psyches and also on our male psyches. If as a woman you never entered the workforce, that is not an issue to deal with if you were excluded from the workforce. But if you work professionally in the workforce, successfully or not, but it's a loss that you have to cope with. And that is all before we talk about the Holocaust as the attempt to kill every Jewish man, woman, and child in Europe.
Yeah. Wow, thank you so much. It reminds me in one of the books, Viktor Frankl speaks about that what helps him to survive, one of the things that helped him to survive, is to go back to his work, like in his imaginary. He goes right. back to the cases, and now you tell, and now you focus and you put a light to the years that for many Jews, they lost their ability to to keep that. And then like it changed. Their masculinity probably changed. And then we have
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the differences that probably is not fully explored yet is like, but we know from memoirs and testimonies of women survivors from the camps, especially from the camps when there's massive hunger and starvation, that one of the things that keeps them alive or that is in the imaginary are recipes and cooking and meals. And you don't find this among men. They might dream about food, but they don't think about recipes, you know. But often we see like they're yearning for something they've lost in terms of how they identify themselves as musicians or rabbis or professionals or doctors, and it's all taken away from them. And now they're nothing, they're nobody. They're just a person with a shovel in their hand that has to dig a ditch if they were in the labor force. And it doesn't count that they were good mathematicians or whoever they were before. You know, that's a different loss and grief. And then a way of being resilient by dreaming about something else that woman did. So is this an important difference? Some people may say, not really, if you look at the end result, because everyone was targeted for death. But if you look at how men and women cope differently with challenging extreme situations, it is interesting.
One of the stories, as someone who grew up in a Hasidic community, is that one of the Hasidic rabbis, he is in a camp, and one of the students, it started a little bit differently. There is a kid who grew up in a Hasidic community, and he wants to see how a rabbi looks like, because, you know, he's in the camp, he has no memories, he's like 8-9 years old, and someone sent him to a man in another room, and he goes there, and he said, like, are you a rabbi? And the Hasidic rabbi, who is shaved, with no pious, with no, all the Jewish way of how a man should look like. And he takes a little picture that he had with him, and he showed to this boy. And the boy said that he see now the rabbi a few years ago with his pious, with his beard, with everything. And like the rabbi needed a reminder. Even the rabbi needs a reminder of who he is, because he lost his masculinity, his ultra-Orthodox image of masculinity in the camp. And another story is I'm thinking about another rabbi who said that the hardest day was not when he lost his family, but the hardest day was for him when he needed to shave, because in the ghetto, he couldn't go to work with unshaved face. So I wonder if you can...
Yeah, I mean, and that is so... Well, that is so true. I mean, you know, we can't even speak and as one of the more Orthodox. And for them, the shaming happens differently than for the Jewish men in Poland, say, who were part of the Bund or the Zionist Bund or part of, a youth group that had Zionist dreams. And they were secular mostly, and they were activists, and some of them were socialist. And there was a lot of misunderstanding between these groups of men to begin with. But the shaming of your outward appearance, you know, if you were Orthodox and the beard was cut off or your hair was cut off or ripped off in some cases, depending on the situation, that's already a shaming that the secular Jewish men would not have experienced. They would have experienced different kinds of shamings later on, but not that kind. So even within Jewish masculinities, we really have to differentiate the kind of experiences that men had. And sometimes that affected your chance of survival or survival rate, or whether you were selected immediately for death or shooting or were not. And whether or not certain jobs opened for you that were called so-called privileged jobs, like the Jewish councils or the Jewish ghetto police or the Ordnungsdienst, places where mostly non-Orthodox Jewish men ended up being complicit to some extent. So, you know, all of these things I feel need our investigative eye in terms of trying to understand what choices men made. And some men renounced their religiousness by the coercion that was there, or by the fact that they felt they wanted to survive, and other men stayed true to their beliefs and maybe died with a certain kind of integrity, but they died because they were unwilling to change.
Yeah, it reminds me, if it's okay, I want to share, like, it reminds me that in Jewish history, one of the ways how Jewish masculinity came to or appear is not by fighting, but by dying to the name of the divine, right? What we call Kiddush Hashem, right. Yes, Kiddush Hashem. And one of the hard parts that we see in the rabbinical literature that was written during the Holocaust, and also 2-3 years after the Holocaust, is that they couldn't die according as Jewish men. They couldn't die by Kiddush Hashem, because in order to die by Kiddush Hashem, in order to die for the name of the divine, you need to have a choice not to die, but convert to another religion, and then you choose to die. And the Nazis didn't give them this honor that they can die for the name of the divine.
Right.
So I'm just thinking how much it makes even the theological, cultural, knowledge and way of life that the Jewish community and Jewish men had, right? So can you?
I think on every level, you know, psychological, theological, religious, cultural, social, and probably to some extent sexual, in terms of your intimate life. I mean, all of that changed, and men had different responses to these changes that were forced upon them. I mean, I'm reminded of just this one little scene. At some point, I had helped a Jewish survivor from Sosnowitz in Poland to get his memoirs published. I helped him edit them and publish them. And early on in Sosnowitz in Poland, he's probably 14 or 15 at the time. He makes a decision to take the place of his father for a forced labor assignment. The Nazis had occupied the town. It was the same thing all over Poland. And they basically said, we need Jewish men to do this, the shoveling of snow in the streets. And the 15-year-old probably at the time says, you know, I'm going to pretend to be my father, because his father was very Orthodox, very easily recognizable. And he thought, you know, I can't send him out there, because the danger of him being humiliated, shamed, forced to shave, or whatever might happen, is not something I can bear. And so as a boy, he takes it upon himself to basically tell his father, you stay home, I will go. Now, this is not a situation that in any place, in any family, is easy to make. But it's also a decision that only a boy could make in relationship to his father, but the daughter of this man could not have made the same choice. You know, she wasn't even given this choice. I mean, it wasn't even part of the possibilities. Yeah. So daughters had to handle these situations very differently than boys. So boys had to make, or young adults or adolescents had to make, certain choices that girls or women weren't even asked to, or weren't even able to contemplate, unless later, as said, some of the women, young women, joined the resistance. But again, these are mostly secular people too. So anyway, I mean, these are all questions that relate to the gender topic, so to speak, or experiences that lead to the gender topic.
Yes, thank you. So can we go to the chapters that focus on the camps. And you have there also, so I wonder if you can bring us some of the questions that you dealt with the book and as a scholar on masculinity, where officially, men and women are totally separated by gender. And some, but in a way, they all look the same because there is no more anymore. Like, you cannot use your clothes or your beard to show that you are more respectful. I like the term that you are using. Like, now I don't know if I'm a Reformed Jew, secular Jew, Bond Jew, Zionist Jew, ultra-Orthodox Jew. I am just a number. I also look kind of the same. I am without any woman, which you show, the book tells us that it's a little bit more complicated. Masculinity is happening, but under such a stress, probably many people, as I learned from the book, didn't feel sexuality. So it's another aspect of masculinity. Some felt it. And then we have also another phenomena that I'm so thankful that you touch it in the book, which is a Muslim man, that it's so hard to even capture what does it exactly mean? And do we have female Muslim men, male Muslim men? So can you elaborate to us, at least the questions, maybe not all the knowledge that we can learn from the book, but the questions that are walking with you?
Yeah. So one advantage of using a gendered lens on men's experiences is that some subgroups get more attention. Subgroups among men, I mean, the, certain cohorts of men or certain groups of men, that certainly never been secreted away or were silenced, but weren't really given that much attention in terms of a experience that relates to gender. They were rather seen or philosophized sometimes as in particular ways. So the Muslim man that you bring up is one of these groups of men. Let me talk about the man first. So Muslim man probably derived from the term Muslim. The German or European term Muslim is in that term probably meant in a derogative sense early on, or it's not really 100% clear how this term emerged, but it's part of the camp language, the Lagersprache, the camp language, that certain men who were seen as having given up any hope for life were classified as Muselmänner, as men who have given up the will to live. And it was seen but that they, you know, if they had an opportunity to wash a little bit, they would stop washing. They lost interest in eating. They lost interest in following the commands quickly enough. You could see that they were ready to die. They had given up any hope for life and they were ready to die, which is different from suicide. I mean, some people committed suicide very intentionally by, say, running against the barbed wire, electrified barbed wire fence, or doing something where they knew they would get shot. And they did this intentionally. But Muslim man was a slow way of saying, I'm done with living. And the men in the camp barracks avoided them. They thought it was contagious, it was toxic, it was you didn't want to be connected to someone who was suddenly seen as a Muslim man. Suddenly one day people realized this man has given up and they tried to avoid being close to him. It was too frightening, you know. And also no one really had any means to help in any significant way anyway. So the new research on men who became Muslim men kind of suggests a more fine-tuned microhistorical analysis of Muslim men experiences, actually shows us that it's less a condition that was final and determined, but a condition that people, that men went in and out of. Until really about a few years ago, Muslim men were discussed as this person who is almost like zombie-like, raising lots of existential questions about who human beings are and what happens if we just give up. And it was just assumed as soon as it starts this process, it's fated and you die. And now we learn through closer look at these men that many people describe actually in the memoirs and in the testimonies that we have that they were seen as a Muslim man at a particular time, but were able to come out of that condition. And sometimes because of a caring moment that some of the other men shared with them. Maybe an extra piece of bread, or maybe some language, or maybe some talk, or something that helped them to be reintegrated into the remaining prison population, and actually got out of that condition. So it's now rather not so much seen as a state with no, as a place of no return, but as a condition out of which you could re-emerge and be reintegrated. Now, if that is the case, then clearly we have more caring relationships in the men's barrack than we often assume. And I say by often assume that men fight for themselves. They're the lonely fighter. They survived because they knew how to take care of themselves. They were not dependent on other people. And if it's true what the new research about Muslim men say, it's like, no, there were actually really caring relationships. People did care for each other, if and when they were able to, because it's a matter of level of exhaustion that you feel and starvation and hunger that makes you just not capable of caring in any normal way that we would think of it. But sometimes just a small gesture was all that these people needed to come back to life.
Wow. And can we say something? Do we know about any differences between male Muslim men and female Muslim men?
It's not my own research specialty, but I can tell you what my contributors wrote about it, and what I read around their own contributions. There were female Muslim men, but they weren't called Muslim men because Muslim man means literally man or mensch, like a Muslim man. It's a very gendered term.
Yes.
So it didn't apply to them. The camp language, there are probably different words for it in different languages, but the one I know is called Schmuckstück, which is a German term, which means, it's like a very ironic term. It means like a piece of jewelry. It's the camp language was brutal in a certain way, or maybe ironic, because that's the last thing you have available to you.
Yes.
Certainly different names could have been used, but these are some of the names or terms that were used. And so women who had given up, who were seen as giving up in the same way, was called Schmuckstück, piece of jewelry, probably because exactly the opposite was true. So they were not a piece of jewelry. They too had given up to wash and take care of themselves. And people kind of stayed away from them because of these reasons. So we have an equivalent there. But for some reason, it is by far less prominent in the testimonies of women to talk about women in this category. And I don't know whether that is because they just didn't feel the need to talk about it, or because it was just less of a phenomenon among women.
Yeah. Or they saw it as less as a phenomenon. Maybe they didn't.
Or they saw it as less as an issue, right?
Yes, less threatening maybe for them and their relationship maybe stayed. Wow. So we still have where to go and to do more research. It sounds like that. So one more. Maybe our last aspect that I want to deal with is deeply connected to chapter 11, which is in the book, and the question of the image of Jewish men also, like after the Holocaust. What's happening when we have the survivors and some of them are going to Israel, and as Israeli, there is a lot of literature about how the Israeli community, society looked on the survivors. You know, when they came to Tel Aviv or they came to the kibbutz, many of them came straight to the independent war of Israel, the Palestinian Nakba, and lost their life. We have graves of people that we don't know the names because they just came as survivors. And in a way, in a very interesting way, some of them or many of them were silenced because it was like, why you never fought? We are fighting here. Some of them maybe redeem some of this shame, and I again, quotation shame, by joining the Israeli army. But then we have the other direction. We have the Jewish men. Let's focus now on the masculine, on masculinity. So Jewish men who stayed in Europe and Jewish men who went to create the Jewish American community and image. And I wonder, can you help us to think about the post-Holocaust masculine Jewish men?
So again, there's a lot to say about this and more to research, I think. But so our book contains two chapters about post-war Jewish masculinities. One relates to the immediate years after the Holocaust, really between 1945 and 1950. And that researcher looked at a German Jewish man who survived and who don't want to stay in Germany any longer. And they either tried to immigrate to Canada or they tried to immigrate to Israel. And in Canada, they are first put in these, camps, that processing camps for immigrants. And in Israel, they kind of try to integrate into Israeli society, which is fairly foreign to them. So this particular study looked at Jewish German men who had of a certain educational class, the so-called Bildungsbürger, the educated middle class, that kind of grew up with a very different self-understanding of what it means to be a man than what they encountered, especially in Israel. In Israel, the ideal masculine, the new ideal masculine was, the farmer, worker, soldier, pioneer, who creates a new society and is active and knows how to defend himself and so on and so forth. And they felt fairly lost with their socialization into a very different kind of value system of what a respectable masculinity would be, namely one of refinement and education and intellectual discussion and white collar job and so on and so forth. And they didn't know what their place is. Some managed to adjust and some got so depressed and frustrated they left either back to Europe or to America because they didn't feel their masculinity is appreciated in the way that they would. They wouldn't necessarily say it in these terms. I mean, that's what scholars do. Yes. But they clearly went through an identity crisis and couldn't handle the new situation. And the other article we have is to look at the emergence of the strong new Israeli masculinity that happens through the war, through the independence, through the 1967 war in film and literature. Mostly this person looks at American literature and American Jewish new masculinities in contrast to the stereotyping of a weak, effeminate masculinity before the Holocaust, basically. And but it's a complicated issue because if Jewish men were seen as effeminate before the 1930s in European culture, it's already based on a prejudiced and biased assumption. So to construct a new Jewish masculinity, is it over against the prejudice or against a certain reality in the ultra-Orthodox community where masculinity was knowledge and learnedness and Talmud and Torah knowledge and not muscles, muscles and physical stuff was not the ideal man. The ideal man was the poor, learned man. And so it gets complicated over against what you posit and how you develop a masculinity against what. Is this against a certain type of reality? Or is it against a certain kind of Gentile perception of Jewish men to begin with? There's no easy answer for it. Mm. But I think there could be more done. You mentioned that in film we have certain depiction of men, and I think there could be more of a gender analysis, a critical masculinity gender analysis when it comes to film and film portrayals that I think is still missing. There's so many ways that assume. I mean, we don't have medical historians to look at the medical experiments done to men and to women and how that differed and what that did to men as opposed to women, depending what experimentation there was. We don't have a strong trauma study approach yet, to looking at different how, say, men coped with their traumatic experiences as opposed to women coping with their traumatic experience in the 60s, 70s, 80s. And as they grew older, age may be an important factor to look at some point. And I'm mentioning these, none of these things happen in our book, but these are the things that we can take it to.
So I will say thank you. Thank you for joining us today. And thank you for editing this important book, The Holocaust and Masculinities. And I really hope it's going to open new gates to new research on these important questions that you are bringing us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.